This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Many of the exiles who left Cuba during the early years of Fidel Castro's rule swore that they would dance on the dictator's grave. 2 weeks ago, following news of his illness and the transfer of power in Havana, hundreds came out onto the streets of Miami to celebrate, but many more stayed in to follow the news and consider their futures. After almost half a century, there is now at least a prospect of change in Cuba that might allow them to go back home. But the reality of their lives today is very different from what they could have imagined 40 years ago. Their families, their businesses, and homes are in the U.S. Their children and grandchildren and more recent arrivals from Cuba don't necessarily share their politics. The definition of what it means to be a Cuban exile has evolved, and so has the definition of Cuban-American. Our main focus this hour is on Cuban-Americans after Castro. Later, some Sunnis in Iraq hope they can escape Shia death squads by pretending to be Shia. We'll talk to a London Times reporter on how Sunnis learn to act Shia, and your letters. But first, being Cuban-American. If you are Cuban-American, call and tell us how things have changed and what the news of Castro's illness means for you. Would you visit or move back if you could? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Our first guest is Maria Cristina Garcia, a professor of history at Cornell University. She joins us from the Cornell studios in Ithaca, New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hello.
Hi. There was a time that the Cuban-American community, is this fair to say, there was a time when this community spoke with one voice?
Well, no. I think the community has always been very diverse. It's just that the hardliners were more vocal and more politically active, and so it seemed like the community was acting or speaking with one voice. But this population has always been very large, very diverse. There are over 1 million people of Cuban descent in the United States today. The majority of them arrived after Fidel took power. Mm-hmm. And I think within this population, there are two political generations. There are those who came of age in Cuba and those who came of age in the United States. And I think they look at the world very differently.
Give us some examples of how they think of the world differently.
Well, for example, those who came of age in Cuba and arrived before 1980 tend to be the most hardline in their attitudes towards Cuba. They tend to support the embargo, the trade ban. They oppose remittances to the island. They are vocal and politically active. Some 80 to 90% turn out to vote on a regular basis in any given election. Those who came of age in Cuba after 1980 are a bit more moderate in their political views. Probably maybe 60% support the embargo, but many of them still have family on the island, and for this reason, they don't favor restrictions on travel. They also lived in Cuba longer and experienced the best and the worst of this revolutionary society and can speak to both, mm-hmm. and this has tempered their views. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you spoke of remittances, which are money people earn here and then send back to their families back in Cuba.
That's correct. Now, there's also a generation or two of Cuban Americans who have come of age in the United States, and they are very different, as you can imagine. They mm-hmm. are not as politically engaged as the older generations. Their voting rates, they're very Americanized in their voter behavior. Their voting rates tend to mirror that of the general population. Only 40 to 50% turn out to vote in any given election. They're proud of their Cuban heritage, but they identify largely with the United States. English is their principal language of communication. And many of them shun exile politics because it's angry, it's sometimes irrational, and very often resorts to name-calling. It's not exactly the political behavior that makes you want to engage. Hmm. Now, having said that, there's also a new generation on the horizon, Cuban-Americans in their teens and early 20s, who are trying to figure out their relationship to Cuba and what role they can play in fostering peace and reconciliation between the United States and Cuba, and it will be interesting to see how they evolve politically over the next few years.
Yeah. You spoke of exile politics when the older generation refused to call itself an immigrant community. It insisted on that exile tag. What's the distinction? What's the importance of it?
Well, they believe that immigrants have a choice, and exiles don't. Exiles are pushed out of their country. And Cubans, those who identify as exiles feel that they were compelled to leave, that they were pushed out of their country for one reason or another. And they have a long list of grievances against the Cuban state.
And among those grievances is an issue that is going to, I think, percolate through the years as a change inevitably comes in Havana. And that is their insistence that they have property rights that were taken from them and businesses that were taken from them.
That's absolutely correct. That is a sore point. And understandably, people on the island are very concerned about this. There are individuals, for example, when I went back to Cuba in 1991, one of the first places I visited was the house where my mother grew up, mm-hmm. and also the house where my father grew up. And when I knocked on the door and I talked to the folks in the house, they were understandably suspicious. They thought that I had come back to scope out the property and because I hoped to one day come back and reclaim it. And, I assured them that at least in my case, that wasn't that wasn't my intention. I feel they've lived there in that property for a much longer period than my family ever did. And that's not what I I think many Cuban Americans feel the same way.
I don't know if your parents are still living, but would they have felt the same way?
Yes, I believe so. My father has since passed away, but my mother feels the same way. She has no intention of returning. She's part of that early migration. We immigrated to this country in 1961, but she feels that this is her country now. And it was difficult enough. It was difficult the first time to uproot oneself and leave one's homeland and come to a new society and try to integrate oneself. And so why uproot yourself a second time? This is her country now.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Gladys. Gladys is calling us from Boynton Beach in Florida.
Yes. Hello. Am I in the air?
Yes, you're on the air, Gladys. Please go ahead.
Hi. I came to this country when I was about 8 years old, and I agree. My generation, I'm now, in my early 40s, but my generation doesn't feel that desperate in terms of having to go back or what's going on politically with Fidel Castro. Certainly, we grew up with our grandparents and our parents telling us about their life in Cuba and how much better it was for them there. But I don't think that my mom, not right now, has Alzheimer's and couldn't tell me, but I don't think she would be the one that if everything all of a sudden falls apart would go back because she would consider this her country now. So I think there is a discrepancy between Cubans who came, recently as opposed to those that came at my time quite some time ago because this is our country now. We don't really feel that much politically inclined to side with the Cubans now in Cuba, or for that matter, be that interested in what's going on with Fidel's state.
Does his illness, Gladys, does his illness really force everybody to think about this again, though?
You mean my mom's?
No, Fidel's.
His illness, I think it just puts it in the forefront, I have little kids, and they ask me about it, and sure, I would love to one day visit and take them and have them go as a vacation spot type of spot, but not to go back and live there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of my generation would probably feel the same. It would be nice to go back to see if we were born there where we were born and what our parents told us, but not that we have an interest in going back to living there or finding what our parents owned and doing any of that sort of. And I can see how the Cubans there would feel a little bit upset, when, like the professor was saying, when she went to visit her mom's home, because they feel there are some Cubans here who feel they're going to go back and take everything that was taken from them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is their country now. They've been here for many years, and they have lives and homes here now. And that wouldn't be fair to the people who stayed there and now inhabit these homes and these farms or, whatever else that they had back home.
Okay, Gladys, thanks very much, and we hope you're the best for your mom.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
All right.
I wonder, Maria Cristina Garcia, you were talking about this diversity, which you say has always existed in the Cuban-American community. Elected officials, at least on the congressional level, and there are three Cuban-Americans in Congress now, all hardliners. How come that diversity isn't reflected in that community?
Well, because my generation, those who came of age in the United States, don't turn out to vote. I don't think the moderates are exercising their political voice, and at least not in the level that they should. I mean, when you look at the voter turnout rates, I mean, those who identify self-identify as hardliner, they have an 80 to 90% voter turnout. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that's going to make that's going to drown out all the other voices.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Elizabeth. Elizabeth calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on my sister-in-law's experience. She met my brother while he was traveling in Cuba. He's American. And then she won the lottery to come here, which she did. Mm-hmm. They subsequently had a baby. When she was being raised in Cuba, she had a very favorable experience under Castro. She was taken through college and then ultimately became an actress on Cuban television. So she has very high opinions of Castro, and were she given the opportunity to go back, which she will have in a year because the 3 years expires in 1 year, she will go back and probably frequently, and were it not for my brother, I'm not sure she wouldn't go back and live there permanently.
Mm-hmm. So Professor Garcia, that's a different opinion.
Yes, I mean, I think you can point to the list of successes in Cuba, and you can also point to a list of failures. And we can talk until we're blue in the face about which list is longer. But it seems to me that at this moment in time, when a post-Fidel leadership is going to draw on a new generation of Cubans for its expertise, scholars, scientists, doctors, engineers, we should be reaching out to that generation, you know, instead of engaging in these discussions about how good Cuba is or how horrible it is. I think, you know, it is what it is. And I think it's important, I think, for this generation to begin to discuss ways that we can improve relations between both countries.
Elizabeth, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We're talking today with Cuban Americans about the future of their community and their relations with their homeland. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Cuban Americans about how they view their future. Our guest is Maria Cristina Garcia, professor of history at Cornell University. When news came of Fidel Castro's illness 2 weeks ago, many of those revelers in the streets of Little Havana and other communities in and around Miami were young Cuban Americans born in the U.S. News of their family's homeland is important to them, but their views sometimes differ from their parents and their grandparents. Susan Anasagasti is a staff writer for the Miami Herald, and she joins us now from the studios of our member station in Miami, WLRN. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much.
You yourself are a young Cuban-American. Tell us, were there people of your generation dancing when this news broke a couple of weeks ago?
Absolutely. You know, for them, it's really, you know, just taking to the streets, it's some sort of calling, it's some sort of sense of responsibility to continue representing the beliefs of their grandparents. It's their way of feeling close or, you know, close to the island despite never having been there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was interesting to see that a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh. And just what kind of relationship, I'm not sure you can speak for your generation, I'm not sure anybody can, but young Cuban American, what kind of relationship do they want to see with Cuba now?
Well, you know, they would definitely, there are different opinions, of course, but mm-hmm. there's one thing that they all agree on, that until Cuba becomes a democratic nation, the island, you know, will remain a place where civil liberties are routinely trampled. And that seems to be the general sense. That seems to be what they express and what they believe.
Mm-hmm.
They would like to see, of course.
And that they would like to see. But we were hearing earlier from Professor Garcia that they are less politically motivated than perhaps the older generation. Would you say that's true?
I would say yes. You know, I think that their motivations are maybe based on sort of the conversations that their parents told them around the dinner table each night. Mm-hmm. It may be less political and in some ways also less emotional, but they would just like to, for them, it's more of seeing this democratic nation. You know, they've been talking about this for so long that that's just sort of, you know, the waiting continues for them.
The waiting continues. So it's this sort of this longing, but not necessarily quite as passionate as their parents, maybe.
Absolutely. For them, I mean, it's still passionate, of course. And you did see this, you know, sort of them taking to the streets and celebrating. But it's a different kind of passion. Just from talking to many of the people out, you know, in Westchester and Little Havana, they, for them, it's almost, you know, to see their parents sort of breathe a little bit or uh-huh. not have to worry so much about the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand the last of your family members, an uncle, just moved to this country a few weeks ago.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. With no family left in Cuba anymore, is this still as important to you as it used to be?
You know, it absolutely is important to me, and it would always be.
Hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
Because,
you know, the main reason is because I grew up in Miami and have deep ties with this community here.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Maria. Maria is calling us from Detroit.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
I came back last Sunday, and I was there when the announcement was made that Castro was sick.
Yeah.
I have more family in Cuba than I have here, and I'm an Afro-Cuban American. I was born in this country, and then I spoke with my uncle, and I asked him, I said, well, what's going to happen? I said, I don't want to be here when Castro passes away. And he looked at me. He says, we have things placed in order, and you heard that Raul is going to be, you know, he has things going on.
Raul Castro, Fidel's younger brother, who's taken the reins of power.
75 years old.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I said, well, he's just as old. What's going to happen with him? Because practically everybody that was involved in the revolution, they're dying as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, well, we have things in order. And he doesn't believe that the when I was in Cuba, I saw the Miami Cubans are jumping up and down and parading.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he doesn't believe that the Miami Cubans have the guts to come in and try to take over, that they want to come in. They want the United States to come in and do something. But he doesn't believe that they have the guts to come in and try to take over whatever, and that they will fight. Now, I see the benefits of communism, and I see the downfalls of communism. My uncle grew up with communism, and my mother, his sister, grew up. She came here before the revolution. I spoke with a couple of Cubans out in the streets or whatever, and I asked them what were their feelings about Castro, and they did not want him to die. These were Afro-Cubanos, and they said that he did so much for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not looking forward to him dying. Now, in Cuba, they don't have, you know, like my family has a computer. They don't have email or anything like that. And I said to him, I said, well, what's going to happen? Do you think you'll ever get email? And my uncle looked at me. He said, yes, of course. He says, I know that we're slow, but when we figure out on how to, you know, get it done or whatever, do it so it will benefit them most, he said that we're going to have that because we don't want to be behind.
Interesting. Professor Garcia, this is certainly not a simple situation.
No, certainly not. I think she's the caller's absolutely right, and I think her family on the island are correct. I think, you know, Fidel has micromanaged the state for such a long time. It's hard to imagine that he hasn't set up a mechanism to ensure the survival of socialism after he's gone. And certainly we already see this. There's Raul, his brother, but certainly there's this whole series of advisors in the Council of State who are positioned to assist him in decision-making with health and education and the economy, et cetera.
Here's an email we got from Miguel in Miami. My family and I arrived in the United States in 1970, me at age 7, my sister at age 8, my brother at age 12. I can tell you that neither one of us nor my parents are interested in returning or taking anything from anyone in Cuba. When we left, my parents left cars, a huge house in one of the most prominent areas, Vedado. And although the new family who lives are part of the Castro regime, we have no interest in taking anything from them, not even from someone with the Castro regime. So, Maria, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Good luck to your family.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I wonder, Susan Asagani, as you listen to that, you know, are people in Miami, is anybody talking about going in and taking over?
No, it's definitely not what I've heard, and definitely not what, you know, the younger generation would like to do. It's more a sense of finally being able to, well, for them, being able to visit the island. And, you know, because many of these people feel that while others can travel there right now, they may not want to because it would sort of be, it would be difficult for their parents to accept. Mm-hmm. So they just long for that opportunity to go and visit and to see where their parents grew up. Because, you know, like I said earlier around the dinner table, you know, this has sort of been the topic of conversation all of their lives. And they themselves can visualize, you know, the city streets and the towns where their parents were born, yet they've never been there and they don't really know. So I think for them, it's not about going to the island and you know, taking back what their grandparents left behind. It's more being able to, you know, go and visit and see where their family is from and where they grew up.
Mm-hmm. Let's get Benjamin on the line. Benjamin's calling us from Monterey in California.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I was a bit amused earlier when Professor Garcia said, you know, we can talk till we're blue in the face about the list of successes versus failures of the Fidel Castro's regime, but it felt, with due respect, a little bit disingenuous since we have not addressed in this conversation the successes of Castro's rule. I am not an advocate of dictatorship. I agree that Castro is a megalomaniac, but he is protecting the poor in decades of hostility from the United States. And many Cuban Americans, especially younger generation Cuban Americans, feel strongly that there is a need for counterbalance to American imperialism in the Western Hemisphere. And it's possible that Cuba, after this time of hostility, will be able to grow to a prosperous socialist country. And although I don't, although I have my doubts about that myself, I was dismayed that the conversation has not had a balanced approach to the great history of American atrocity against Cubans, and also the fact that Castro has not himself been violent against his own people, even though he has compromised their civil liberties in many cases.
Professor Garcia.
I see your point, but I understood the topic of today's session, the attitudes of Cuban Americans towards the island. I mean, certainly what you say is correct. We can point to the island's, to the Cuban state's many successes, certainly in education and in healthcare, and perhaps we can dedicate an entire show to that topic. And I'm sure the hardliners would like to see a topic of, you know, a session of equal length addressing some of the limitations of the Cuban state. But I think what's important, at least from my perspective, is to figure out where do we go from here. You know, as a historian, of course, I spend a lot of time talking about U.S.-Cuba relations. I teach a course on this topic, and we spend a lot of time going into great detail about these ties of singular intimacy, to quote one of my colleagues at North Carolina. But I think the important point is to try to figure out where we're going from here. And my opinion is I feel that the Bush administration's policy is off the mark. It's misguided. And I think we're losing an opportunity to contribute to some very interesting changes that will allow the Cuban state to retain the best of the revolutionary society and at the same time create some of the reforms that some exiles would like to see on the island.
Yes, well, thank you. I agree that this is very important. I think it is the responsibility of Cuban Americans to ensure that policy toward Cuba does not repeat the problems of the past, and that true democracy in Cuba requires protection of some of the values of that society over the last several decades.
Susan Anastasia, let me bring you into this conversation. I wonder what you think of what Benjamin had to say.
You know, it's interesting. I think that, like what Professor Garcia said, it would have to be, an equally balanced conversation. But again, it's more important to just sort of look to the future now, sort of based on the circumstances and talk ahead instead of looking behind and deciding, with what was done in the past.
Okay. Benjamin, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're talking today about Cuban Americans and how they see their future and the future of their country that they came from. We're in the future of the country that they live in now, the United States. I'm Neil Cunningham. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Tony. Tony calling from Miami.
Yes, hi.
I'd
like to make a comment.
Sure.
One of the comments I think that hasn't really been touched upon is the fact that I think that as a young Cuban American, I've been in this country since I was born in this country, I should say, and I'm in my mid-40s. And what I found is that people of Cuban background, depending on their socioeconomic level within our community, have different opinions about how they would like to go back or not go back. And I find that those that have not been as successful in this country tend to have more of a feeling of wanting to return than those that I think have been, more successful or of a higher socioeconomic level.
Professor Garcia, we've talked about generational differences. How much about this is differences in class?
I think the caller is absolutely correct. I'm often asked who's likely to return to Cuba, assuming that the Cuban state allows Cuban Americans to return, and that's a big if. I think those the more recent arrivals are probably among the more likely to return. Those who feel disaffected, who never quite adapted to U.S. society for whatever reason, either because they didn't learn the language or weren't able to find earn a livelihood that was to their satisfaction. The disaffected, I think, would be more likely to return. What I do see happening, again, and this is a big if, assuming that the Cuban state one day allows this to happen, I do see a lot of traveling back and forth across the Florida Straits. There's a long history, of travel back and forth across the Florida Straits. Long before Fidel took power, Cubans were living in the United States, Americans were living in Cuba and traveling, spending part of their lives in each other's country. And I could see that happening again. Cuba is very close to the state of Florida, 100, 110 miles. I could very easily see a scenario where Cuban Americans live in South Florida, hop on a plane and go to Santiago de Cuba or Havana or any of a number of cities and, operate a business there and then come back home at the end of the day in much the same way that other Americans commute between Washington, D.C. and Boston and New York. We could see a commuter society of sorts. But again, all of this is dependent on whether the Cuban state allows this to happen. And given the long history of conflict between exiles and people on the island, it might not be possible. And that's where I think the new generation steps in. And on both sides of the Florida Straits, I think this is where the new generation will be important.
Tony, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Of course, there are still Cubans coming to the U.S. every year, many of them born under the Castro regime and who never knew anything else. Oscar Corral is another reporter for the Miami Herald. He covers the Cuban exile community for that newspaper. He's also with us from the studios of WLRN in Miami. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Neil.
How different are these recent immigrants from the earlier generations, both from 50 years ago and from Mariel?
Well, the first wave of immigrants that came from Cuba suffered the brunt of the communist revolution. They lost property. They had homes and cars and all kinds of private property confiscated, and that's the rancor that they brought with them and what charged them politically. They had their lives stripped from them by this revolution. That's the way they feel about it. This newer generation of immigrants was born and raised mostly under the Castro government. And they never went through that shock of losing everything that they worked for. They never experienced owning anything in Cuba, because in Cuba it's illegal to own anything. It's illegal to own property or cars or businesses. So they never experienced that shock of having lost everything that they worked for. They come here with a different attitude. They are more apolitical. They tend to view Cuba through a prism of economic just economic longing. They couldn't make a living for themselves in Cuba. They've crossed the Florida Straits looking to make a living, looking to make enough money to send back to their families. They have not gotten involved with the politics of exile.
We're going to have to take a short break, and hold on, all three of you. We'll be back to continue this conversation with Cuban Americans. Plus, we'll hear from some Sunni Muslims in Iraq about why some Sunni Muslims in Iraq pretend to be Shia and how they're learning how to do it. And plus, your letters. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking with Cuban Americans about their reaction to the possibility of political change in their homeland. Our guests are Maria Cristina Garcia, a professor of history at Cornell University, and two reporters for the Miami Herald, Susan Anasagasti, a staff writer, and Oscar Corral, a reporter for the Miami Herald who covers the Cuban exile community. And Oscar Corral, we just introduced you just before the break. And I wanted to ask you more about this the differences between the more recent arrivals and the flow of people. We saw that big bulge during the boat lift, Marielle, but in fact there have been more people coming in the past few years than even arrived back in the 80s.
That's right, Neil. It's been a steady flow of Cuban immigrants coming into the Miami area, into the United States from Cuba. Over the last 5 years or 6 years alone, we've seen about 130,000 Cuban immigrants arrive. That is more than arrived during the entire Mariel boat lift. So it's a steady stream of immigrants, in part fueled by a visa lottery that the United States has, which provides 20,000 exit visas to Cubans every year legally to come to the United States. So we are constantly being, refreshed or injected with new arrivals from Cuba who bring with them the attitudes of the moment that dominate the island. And right now, the immigrants that are coming here, I did a story a few weeks ago about the new arrivals. And right now what you're seeing is a group of people who are so tired and just sick of politics that they don't want to have anything to do with it. They don't want to have to do with the politics in Cuba, and they don't want to have anything to do with the politics in Miami. They just want to live their lives. They just want to work and send money home to their families. Some of them don't necessarily hate the Cuban government. Some of them do. Some of them just they don't want to know how the exiles here felt in the early waves. They just want to get on with their lives, and that change in attitude over the years, I think, is a reflection of people being raised under the Cuban government and their system. It's people who have never understood or been subjected to capitalism or any sense of democracy, where speaking out could cost you your freedom. Where being in a country where longing to make an extra buck on a street corner by selling some flowers or selling some sugar could land you in jail, that's the system they were raised in. Every block in Cuba has a snitch essentially for the Cuban government, and people are concerned to express their true feelings in Cuba, and that translates into their experience in Miami. Mm-hmm. Many of the people I interviewed for that story, many of the new arrivals, didn't even want to talk about how they felt about the Cuban government. It was still that fear that they carried with them from the island. And it's a fear that translates into just apathy and an apolitical attitude.
Susan Anasagasti, I wanted to ask you, do Cuban Americans, are these distinctions instantly recognizable? Can you tell immediately when somebody came?
Well, it depends because, certainly when news broke that Castro had transferred power to his brother Raul, in the area that I was covering, sort of in Little Havana, Westchester, the younger Cuban Americans there had been raised by parents who came, who came to the United States. They were the original wave of Cubans who came to the United States in the early 60s. So there is a difference there. So I would say that probably the majority of those feel differently than the ones Oscar speaks about.
No, I was talking about sort of social distinctions. Do these groups interact? Do they mingle? Do they talk to each other? Do they help each other out?
they definitely interact and they definitely mingle, but there is a difference. There is a distinct difference mm-hmm. between them. And it's probably because of the different life experiences that they've each had, raised differently and different times that they've, you know, came to the United States and even in the politics of it all, they may not agree mm-hmm. with each other.
Let's talk with Pedro. Pedro's calling us from Miami.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Well, my comment is that I belong to possibly the last generation that witnessed a pre-Castro Cuba. I was 11 years old when I came here. My parents brought me over with my brothers and sisters. And I think the sense that our generation has is that we want to see our parents vindicated. I mean, these are folks who led very decent lives in Cuba. They didn't torture anybody. They were not part of the Batista regime, but yet they suffered greatly. And I'm not just talking about material loss. I'm talking about jail time. I'm talking about a family member killed by the government. And my parents spent their whole lifetime working very actively to see a free Cuba. And I think the sense that we feel when we see the beginning of the end of the Castro regime is a sense of vindication. It isn't a sense of revenge or a desire to get properties back. It is simply, it's a very simple wish to see the motherland of our parents and where we were born free once more.
You see, we obviously, Fidel Castro turned 80 just the other day. He's obviously ill. We may be seeing the beginning of the end of Castro. Do you, Pedro, see the beginning of the end of the Castro regime?
I do. I don't see it immediately. I don't believe that the physical passing away of Fidel will signify the end of his regime. I think that their political machinery is very powerful and it has tremendous control over the country. But I think that change becomes inevitable because the internal contradictions of that system are massive. I visited Cuba 3 years ago. I went back after a lot of soul-searching, and, mm-hmm. and what I saw there was a wonderful, beautiful country with lovely, hospitable people run by an absolutely despicable regime. And I think that once the people begin to understand that there's a little bit of wiggle room and they begin to see that there is the possibility of change, there will be the floodgates will open and there will be a massive popular demand for change.
Pedro, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
And we've heard a number of opinions. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there, but I wanted to thank our guests. Maria Cristina Garcia, professor of history at Cornell University, joined us from the studios at that university in Ithaca, New York. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
And two reporters for the Miami Herald, Susan Anasagasti as a staff writer and Oscar Corral, a reporter for the Miami Herald, and they joined us from the studios of our member station in Miami, WLRN. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks,
thank you.
When we return, we'll go to Baghdad.